The BBC presents My Word. Here to introduce the program and the panel is Jack Longland.
My Word is a word game played by people whose business is words, and those taking part are Ann Scott James, Dennis Norden, Dillis Powell, and Frank Muir. The first round tries to test their respective vocabularies, and for 2 marks, I want them to tell me the meaning of these words. Dennis Powell, what does demiurge mean? D-E-M-I-U-R-G-E, demiurge.
Demiurge?
That's all I get now.
Well, with increasing age, it is, as Frank says, all you have. It also has, I believe, a kind of godlike significance.
Yes, it does. Yes. Remember what it comes from?
Demiurge. It must be sort of classical.
It is classical?
It's classical. It's kind of half god.
Yes, I think I'll give you a mark for that. It's a rather neat shorthand for what I've got. It's a name for the creator of the world in Plato's philosophy, and among the later heretical Gnostics, it was a subordinate creator, rather sort of less than God, but rather especially responsible for man. And it means just a craftsman, demiurgos. 2 marks. Dennis Norden, what does or did gigmanity mean? G-I-G and then manity. Gigmanity.
I haven't the faintest trace of an idea. It sounds like a film star, actually. From the pages of the thundering west comes gigmanity in his grip. I don't know, Jack. It's a man who looks after a gig, and yes. It is the whole concept of men looking after gigs, yes. Gigmanity.
The other thing you can do, if you're a bit grander than looking after a gig, is
drive a gig, own a gig.
Own a gig. Oh, that kind of gig. I see. Yes. I was thinking something kind of...
And who would they be?
They would be the gentry, the people.
Oh, carriage folk.
The carriage trade.
Yes. All right, 2 marks. It's Thomas Carlyle's word for the respectable, unimaginative middle classes, whom he considered rather philistine. Now, Ian Scott James, what's the meaning of Gromwell? Like Cromwell, but with a G at the beginning. Gromwell.
Gromwell sounds like something out of Lewis Carroll. I suppose it is it?
No.
Oh dear. You know, An old word.
It's rather up your garden.
Perhaps it's an Elizabethan, a rustic word for the common daisy.
Well, I don't know how to mark this at all.
Badly, I can see.
I'm going to give you half a mark. It's kinds of plant with stony seeds. They're called lithospermum. The borage family belongs to it. And it was formerly used in medicine for the cure of gravel, if you were unfortunate enough to have that disease. Oh. Frank, what does hype mean? H-I-P-E. Hype. Hype.
Hype, Jack, is the Christian name of a self-pitying Irishman called O'Condriac. It's also the all-purpose Sergeant Major's word of command. It's by the lift, quick, hip. About, hip.
It was really slope, hip, with your rifle. I'm bound to give you that. It wasn't what I intended. It is, in fact, a wrestling term. It means to throw your opponent by lifting him from the ground and rapidly placing one of your knees between his thighs.
Ooh.
And over he goes. Over he goes.
Hype!
Well, before we begin the next round, I'm going to read out a quotation for each team to write down, and the two women members will go on studying those quotations, because at the end of the program, I shall ask them where the quotations come from. Dennis Powell and Frank Muir, your quotation is a rose-red city, half as old as time. And Anne Scott James and Dennis, yours is De mortuis nil nisi bunkum. Then, in the last round, I shall ask Frank and Dennis to give me their ideas of how these came to be said or written. And now, not very serious round of inside-out definitions. What I do is to give the definition first, and I want members of the team to tell me what it refers to. 2 marks again. Dennis Powell, a grain which in England is generally given to horses, but in Scotland supports the people.
Oats.
By whom?
Dr. Johnson.
Absolutely right. It's oats. Sam Johnson, rather perversely, used it as a definition in his dictionary of the English language. The Scots weren't very pleased.
Yes, and a Scotsman said, you can tell the result from the quality of the horses in England and the men in Scotland.
Yes, sir. Now, Dennis Norton, when is it that, having a choice of two temptations, you choose the one which will get you home earlier?
Oh, that's one of the definitions of middle age.
Yes, well done. Too long.
One is it's when the broad mind and the narrow waist change places.
Well done. Anne Scott James, what state is defined with cruel accuracy in the following vignette? A woman's hairnet tangled in a man's spectacles on top of the bedroom dresser.
A man's...
woman's hairnet tangled in a man's spectacles...
Spectacles, Baron.
On top of the bedroom dresser. What state is described?
You do it.
Matrimony,
isn't it? Yes.
What do you think it was?
Matrimony or marriage.
I never can work these things out backwards. I think forward, surprisingly.
Now, Frank, now, what's the word for a substitute to remind the star that the show can go on without him?
Understudy.
Yes. 2 marks it is. Now, this is a round of slightly odd words and expressions, and I want to know what they mean and also how they came to have that meaning. 2 marks for reasonably correct answers. Let us power white knight, not a K in it, white knight.
Oh, well, I think that means a night when you don't have any fun.
It might.
Nuit blanc. That's what it means in the...
I'm going to give you 1 out of 2. It means a sleepless night. And you may admit to my... Dennis Norton.
Depends whether you spend the night worrying.
Dennis Norton. Borough English. Borough like borough and English like English. Borough English.
I can only presume it's the kind of English that's used in those notices that the local borough council put out. There was one that said, no road beyond the cemetery. there was a bus at Uxbridge that said, passengers alight, both ends. I would call that borough English.
I think you'd be dead right, but not on in this particular context. Half a mark for ingenuity. It's the custom by which property and real estate passed to the youngest and not to the oldest son. And if there was no son, it went to the youngest daughter and so on. No wife and children, it went to the youngest sister. And because it was pretty screwy and different from ordinary Norman French inheritance, it was called borough English. Hans Scott James, the woolsack.
Well, the woolsack is the thing upon which the Lord Chancellor sits.
Can you describe it?
I think it derives from the Middle Ages, when wool was the source of all our wealth, and it's a kind of cushion stuffed with wool.
Absolutely right. 2 marks. And now Frank Miller's question. Vinland. V-I-N-L-A-N-D. Vinland.
I think it's an Englishman's name for the Bordeaux area of France.
Well, that's the right kind of clue, but it's the wrong side. No. For Bordeaux.
Not Scandinavian.
Yes, you're...
Scandinavian. Oh, it goes back to those horrible sort of Middle Ages legends.
Yes, what were they doing?
Vikings, they were being Vikings.
Yes, and how far did they go to the west?
Scunthorpe. They ravaged Scunthorpe.
I think they got to America.
That's what I'm...
They got to America.
I'm trying to get out of it.
They got to America.
1.5. It's the name given in the old Norse sagas to the bits of the North American coast which were discovered long before Columbus by Eric the Red and other explorers in about the 11th century. And they probably got as far as what is now New Jersey and found grapevines growing there and so called it Vinland. Well, now we come to the last round and go back to those two quotations I gave the teams earlier in the programme. 2 marks, Nilis Powell. Can you give me the origin of your quotation, which was a rose-red city half as old as time?
Well, it's the first line, I think, of a poem about Petra.
And Petra is what?
Petra is a city which I've long wanted to visit and probably never lived to do.
And do you remember who wrote this?
I can't remember his name. He's a reverend gentleman.
Yes, he was.
He never wrote anything else, did he?
In fact,
so I can't remember his name.
One and a half. He was the Reverend John William Burgon, and he wrote this for the Poetry Prize, the Newdigate Prize at Oxford. And as you quite rightly said, nothing is much recorded of him being memorable that he wrote after that. And it was about the city of Petra. And Scott James, can you give me the origin of your quotation, which was De mortuis nil nisi bunkum?
Well, I think it's a witty corruption of a famous Latin saying, bunkum should really be bonum.
Yep. And by whom?
Well, I don't know, but I think it's some political writer, and I should think it was either Bernard Shaw or possibly Maynard Keynes. It's as near as I can get, but I really don't know.
Pretty near, 1.5 marks. It was actually Harold Lasky. And now I'm going to ask Frank and Dennis to give me their improbable explanations of how these quotations came into being. And for this round only, the marks will go to whichever unlikely story gets the longer applause from the audience here in the theatre. So back to Frank Muir and A Rose-Red City Half as Old as Time.
Now this line, A Rose-Red City Half as Old as Time, is one that I saw in my diary this morning. I was reading the diary of my summer holiday in Corsica, and there I'd written Tuesday, A Rose-Red City Half as Old as Time, well, pretty nearly that. And it was the morning after the worst, I think one of the worst holiday days I have ever spent. The reason for this was that before going on holiday, a television company rang up and said they've got this great idea for a program. They'll give 3 of us a cine camera each, an 8mm, and we'll take 1 3-minute reel on holiday, and we can't edit it. We've got to show it, warts and all, exactly as taken. And they'll have the 3 of us back on the programme, and they'll show the films to the viewing dozens. It's rather late-night programme. And then sort of interview us about making it. So we thought this was rather jaunty. And I had to think, I was going to be in it. You see, my son was going to film it and direct. And I was going to provide the idea and sort of act it. And I came up with this idea of a little scene of a rather shy Englishman going for a bathe on a deserted Mediterranean beach. And he climbs through the mackie from the little railway station and staggers onto the beach and gets a boot full of water and tests the temperature under the thermometer, and it's just right. But then he gets very worried about undoing his buttons. You know, so he gets into one of these tent affairs that my wife has, yours probably has too, and you do it up at the neck, you see, and he struggles like mad for hours under this tent effect, and eventually throws it off, and he's in full white tie and tails. And he then dives into the water and swims off into the sunset, and that's the end of the film. Well, decided to do the film on the second week, have a bit of a holiday first, and we chose a beach near Île Rousse, for those of you who know Corsica. You can only get to this beach. It's about 2 miles away from Île Rousse, and there's a tiny little train, little Michelin goes, just a one-carriage train with a diesel thing. We got onto the beach and started filming, and it was a baking hot day, and we shot it, and I dived in, and there I was, and it's incidentally, you float in clothes. Did you know that? It's marvellous. You float. I think about 10 minutes later you drown. But and then my wife said, well, you better hurry and change, because the train is due now, and it's about a 5-minute run through the mackie, but it's always 10 minutes late. And just as she said that, we heard, haw, ha, haw, ha, the sound of the train. It was on time, for the first time within living memory. We hurtled through the tundra and just made the train. I, in this soaking wet, white... That wasn't too bad, but when we got out, we had to get to the car, which was in the main little place at Île Rousse. And a lady said, excuse me, but my sister and I are on holiday from Carl Shalton. Aren't you Frank Muir? And then she suddenly noticed what I was wearing. So I thought I'd just been best man at a French wedding. The champagne was a bit lively with the heat. But whether it was talking to her and whether it was getting so hot and wearing this wet thing when the wind, the evening wind had started, but when I woke up in the following morning, the morning I was telling you about, I really felt pretty rotten on 80. Now, if I'd entered my diary up in full, instead of using nice diary shorthand, I would have written, woke up, burnt absolutely red with standing in the sun all day yesterday, the red very painful and throbbing, also feeling very seedy, not exactly ill, but just very, very seedy, and I have a stomach condition which can only be likened to that of Isolde, who, if you remember, when she found that Tristram was dead, committed suicide from an overdose of purge. That is what I would have replied if I'd written in full, but I wrote my diary in diary shorthand, and I read it this morning, and diary shorthand really does come out poetic, because I said all that, but it came out. A rose, red, seedy, have Isolde's tongue.
What a sensational life Frank leads. You better see if Dennis's is quieter. And if you remember, his quotation was, De mortuis nil nisi bunkum.
This is the quotation that I think of whenever I hear somebody say, you can never find a policeman when you want one. Because whether that's true or not, I'll tell you something that I've found out from personal experience. You can't find a lady fireman when you want one. Now, if you ask me, under what sort of circumstances would you particularly require a lady fireman, I'll tell you what sort of circumstances. Very dire circumstances. In my case, circumstances involving a lady that I think I've mentioned on this program a couple of times, Mrs. Flora Treadgold. Now, for those unfamiliar with this program, she is the sort of Elsa Maxwell of Hampstead Garden Suburb. I don't know exactly how much her first husband left her. All I can tell you is she's the only person I know who gets Christmas greetings from the World Bank. So when I received an invitation to a lunchtime drinks party to celebrate her birthday, I was naturally rather chuffed, to say the least. The only problem was, what sort of birthday present should I bring? Because this really was a case of what can you give the woman who does have everything. Then I had a brainwave, an absolute brainwave. Did you see that newspaper article about this manufacturer in the Midlands who's making a fortune exporting to America perfect replicas of a medieval cast iron chastity belt? And sure enough, when I presented it to her, when I turned up there and gave it to her, she was thrilled to bits. Oh, she said, do look, everyone, look, what a hoot. Isn't this a hoot? I must pop upstairs and put it on. So she slipped upstairs, and I was absolutely in. Everybody wanted me to introduce me to everybody else. And that is how I met Giorgio. Now, Giorgio was an Italian water skiing instructor whom Flora had brought back from Portofino. He didn't speak a word of English. He had one of those handshakes where it takes 10 minutes afterwards for your knuckles to get back into line. And it was while I was nursing my hand that Flora made her big announcement. Quiet, everybody, said, quiet, quiet. Now I can reveal my big birthday secret. Today, at 11 o'clock, Giorgio and I were married at the Hampstead Registry Office. And silence, absolute stunned, everybody was. She'd been a widow for years, you see. And she went on, and this afternoon, at 5 o'clock, we're catching a plane to Portofino for our honeymoon. She said, I'm just going upstairs to change into my going-away outfit. Can I have the key? Yes, of course, I told. By Jove, you'd better have that, you see, and I reached into my pocket. Do you know the expression, suddenly taken sober? Because it was then, and only then, that I remembered that as I got out of my car, what with my being so nervous and under such a strain and everything, I'd had one of my nosebleeds. And there's only ever been one cure for my nosebleeds. A cold key slipped down my back. Now, fortunately, I remembered exactly where I was standing when I put that chastity belt key down my back. It was on a grating over a drain. When I dragged myself back into the house, the festivities had cooled down quite a bit. Somebody said, surely there's a spare key. Well, I said, no, it would sort of defeat the whole purpose of the thing, wouldn't it? All right, said Flora. Her eyes never left mine. Ring the fire brigade. All right, said the chief fireman when he came through the door. What's the trouble, then? Well, look here, I said, have you got among your crew such a thing as a lady fireman? Look, sir, he said, don't go to pieces, sir. All I want you to tell me, sir, at this moment about the incident is, will I need the extension ladder? No, I said, you won't. And taking him to one side, I explained the truth of the situation. Well, I must say, he was really terribly nice. Oh, he says, we often get calls to break open locks. He said, look, he said, I'll tell you what, sir. He said, if the lady would just pop upstairs to her room with me, it won't take me a minute to undo that. It'll take me a minute, even with a blindfold on. He said. And it wouldn't have taken him a minute, I'm sure of that. Only Giorgio took it into his mind just at that moment to burst joyously into his bride's bedroom, where there was this fireman with her, with his helmet off, holding this pair of pliers. Now, as I said, Giorgio didn't understand a word of English, you know, and what with that hot Latin blood. And seeing the fireman's axe. Well, as I said at the trial, you see, that the trouble is... the trouble is you just cannot find a lady fireman when you need one. Now, if you're wondering by now what this fact can possibly have to do with De Mortuis Nil Nisi Bunkum, it's because Flora's predicament with her antique lock was so relevant to the author of that quotation, her old lost key.
By your vote, ladies and gentlemen, it is Dennis Norden that wins the story contest, but all the same, Dennis Power and Frank Muir win the entire contest, and that brings to an end this edition of My Word.
My Word, you heard Dillis Powell, Anne Scott James, Frank Muir and Dennis Norden, introduced by Jack Longland, who also compiled the questions. The program was devised by Tony Schwein and Edward J. Mason and presented by the BBC.